So just given how hard it is for maybe a victim to speak out, how did you go about finding victims and convincing them to speak with you?
That took a lot of patience. That was the hardest part. Surprisingly, getting in touch with military officials and obtaining interviews with them was not the hard part about that story. We actually found that the Canadian forces were quite collaborative, and I think that's thanks to my colleague Alec Castonguay's previous work on military issues, and he's quite respected as a journalist, even within the military establishment. The hard part was finding victims and getting them to talk to us, or convincing them to talk to us. I ended up meeting with about a dozen women and two men who have suffered, who experienced sexual assault at different periods within the last 30 years. The way that I went about trying to convince them to open up to us was really to try to establish a relationship with them that made them feel empowered about sharing their story, rather than making them feel like I'm taking their story and running away with it and they have no control over the way it's going to be used. So I really tried to approach them in a way that they could, to make them feel that they could control the setting of the interview itself, and that they could have a say over what was going to be, how their story was going to be used. Because, of course, for these women, what they've experienced is something that has taken their power away from them. So you really don't want to go in there and make that powerlessness even stronger. On the contrary, you want to empower them as well, and you want to make the experience as positive as possible for them. So that entailed, you know, sharing information with them, letting them really set the terms for the interviews in advance, letting them, without, of course, having them read the story before publication — that did not happen — but informing them of, you know, I'm going to say this, this, and this about you. Are you okay with that? And I think, you know, the ethics were a little bit different with subjects like these than with regular interviewees, I would say.
One thing that really stuck out to me from your article is that when you spoke with a psychologist who talked about this idea of women coming into a space that's traditionally male, and somehow violence sometimes reflecting a backlash against women coming into that space. Mm. Could you tell me a little more about that?
Absolutely. The professor that I interviewed is Jennifer Burdall, and she's an organizational psychologist with the School of Management at University of Toronto, and she studies workplace harassment, and she studied this extensively. And I was talking to her about, you know, how does it happen? Why does it happen in some work environments more than in others? And what she says is that it often happens in environments where men are where there are more men than there are women, and where men are more powerful than women. And in those cases, when women do start to enter into that male-dominated territory, some men, of course, not all of them, and not all military men either, but some men will react and try to defend their own privileged status within the organization, and they will, some of them will, taunt, humiliate, assault, or sexually assault in some cases even, in order to protect their own status within the organization by, putting the women in their place, if I can express myself that way. And it's very interesting because what I found, another common thread throughout all of the stories of the women that I interviewed, is that the sexual assault rarely happened in isolation. It happened against a background of a sexist climate. almost all of the women I spoke to not only suffered a sexual assault, but they described a work environment where sexual remarks, like sexually explicit remarks, unwanted advances from superiors towards their subordinates, sexual rumors, that sort of thing. They described a kind of environment where those things were accepted and were tolerated by superiors. So I think that's one of the things that's really important in that story, because people will tend to say, well, you know, that was just a joke. When people make sexist comments, you know, that was just a joke. But actually, there are research studies that have studied what are the risk factors for rape in the military. And two of the most important risk factors were, one, a work environment that was sexualized and hostile, so with sexist comments and demeaning gestures and jokes, etc. And the second risk factor that was the most important was leadership, the attitude of leadership. If leaders or superior officers witnessed these kinds of behaviors and didn't react, if they tolerated them, allowed them to flourish, the risk factors for rape, the risk for rape was multiplied by 3 or 4. So it's really important when we talk about sexual assault, it's also important to address the underlying context and the underlying climate within which those kinds of incidents occur.
I also want to just go back to the documents that you got through the Access to Information Act. So I think in the journalism world, like a lot of people are familiar with, sometimes the length of time that it might take to get access to a document, or sometimes when you do, those documents are processed, a large part might be redacted. I'm wondering just what was the timeline? Like, can you tell me a little bit about the process for filing and then receiving the documents that you got?
We received a CD of documents even last week. But we as soon as we started working on the story, my colleague Alec initiated several requests because he knew it was going to take a long time. So probably in June, I would say, of last year, in June 2013, he started requesting documents, things like incident reports written by the military police about sexual assaults, and we requested the incident reports for the past 5 years for Quebec bases, so Saint-Jean, Sur-Richelieu, Bagotville, and Valcartier. And we actually just received the Valcartier ones just last week. So that took months and months and months. And sometimes they reply to you and they say, well, actually, you know what, we can't. It's going to be too much work for us to process. So they inform us that our request is going to take another, I don't know, months, another few months to treat, and then you can actually file a complaint. And this is more of Alec's domain, so I'm not extremely comfortable describing every little detail, but it does take months to obtain those kinds of documents. And, of course, when you do receive them, well, they're very hard to read because they're heavily redacted, as you mentioned.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is your own background, and I heard that you had a personal connection to the military.
My father is a retired officer from the Canadian Forces, and I spent the first few... So this is an environment that I know very well and that I highly respect and that I have a lot of affection for, because, yes, I do have a very close and personal connection to this world. I spent the first few years of my life on the base at Valcartier. My first 2 years of school were on the base at Valcartier. So I like to say that this is a story that I did out of love, not at all out of an anti-military sentiment at all. I do have a lot of respect for the men and women who make that choice, very often out of extremely noble ideals. And I'm always impressed when I interview military men and women and ask them, you know, why did you get into the military? And their answer are full of noble ideals about service, about sacrifice, about exploring your own limits and going beyond them and helping people in need and doing the right thing. And that is something that I deeply, deeply respect. And the reason why I wanted to do this story so much is that I want you know, men, but also women especially, to be able to make that choice without fear and in full confidence and in full safety.
So in 1998, Maclean's ran a series looking at the exact same issue.
Yes.
There were four cover stories looking at this culture of rape. And we had a team of reporters and editors that looked at the issue for about 9 months and discovered, again, a broken complaint system that really did not, wasn't too helpful for victims. So given that that was reported about 16 years ago and the issue seems very much the same, how much do you think that the system might change now?
I'm a bit hopeful, and I think I'm kind of hopeful. I think things have changed since the 1990s. Of course, I read all of those cover stories, and they were an inspiration. All aspects of those stories were an inspiration, and I think I do believe that things have changed. I do believe that there's better training now for. You know, recruits and other military personnel. I do believe that the policy against sexual harassment is stronger. However, I also think that there's still a long way ahead. I also think that in some ways the military establishment is perhaps a little bit complacent sometimes because they've put in place all of those measures and their zero tolerance policy and these, you know, conflict resolution programs. And I think they, and because things have improved, I think they think that they've done enough. And I disagree. I think that being a male-dominated organization, they have to be even more proactive because it's the kind of work environment that's going to be fertile ground for harassment, whether they want it or not. So they have to be even more proactive in fighting sexual harassment and sexual assault. So, and the other thing is that I think there's also a dissonance. Between policy and what is going on the ground in units. I think their policy is fantastic. It's zero tolerance. And when you ask them questions or when they send you, you know, their they send you their statements, they keep repeating this over and over. We have a zero tolerance policy. Well, of course you do. But how come then you interview women and some of the women that I interviewed every day for 6 months within a combat unit in Valcartier, every day for 6 months she came into work and she was insulted with, and I don't even want to repeat, I wouldn't even know how to translate in English the kinds of, you know, very bad words that she was told every day for 6 months in front of superiors and nobody did anything. So, yes, there is a zero tolerance policy, but I think it has yet to penetrate every layer of the organization down to the very bottom and down to every rank and every unit.
That's incredible that those kinds of things are happening, given the policy. Going back to 1998, mm-hmm. after the series of articles that Maclean's had were published, an ombudsman's office was created. And I want to ask you about some of your interviews with Alain Gauthier.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about, I found that the wording of this kind of interesting. They're hoping to put together a team to look at the complaint procedures, but I'm wondering what that means. Hoping, what are they actually doing?
The final decision hasn't been made yet, so I think our story is going to put a little bit a little bit more pressure on him to make that final decision than perhaps he had hoped to. But Alain Gauthier is the Director General of Operations at the Office of the Ombudsman of the Canadian Forces and National Defense. And when I met him last fall, and I spoke to him a couple times since, and he was very aware of the issues and very much aware of the fear of negative repercussions for women and men who file complaints of harassment and sexual assault. So, and what he told me is that one of their missions is to carry out systemic investigations of different issues that they deem important enough to look into more deeply. And the issue of harassment in general and sexual violence in particular, for him, was worthy of a systemic investigation. But the final decision hasn't been made yet, because they don't do these kinds of investigations every week. So that's what the word hoping comes from. They haven't made their final decision yet, but it was one of these systemic investigations that they were considering, and that they said were on top of the pile.
Okay, and you also mentioned that you saw a recent study on sexual harassment in the workplace, or a preliminary version. What was the study saying in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, two things: that the rate of sexual harassment has been decreasing in the Canadian Forces for the past 20 years. That's pretty much the only way that they assess sexual violence with this kind of survey, and it's the third survey that they carried out last year, the third survey in 22 years, so it's not exactly... it's not exactly an issue that they follow closely. But the sample size is so small that it's very hard to draw any conclusions from it. It's very hard, for example, to determine what is the percentage of people who have experienced sexual assault, because their sample size is too small, and it remains a rare issue. So if you want to really evaluate precisely how widespread the phenomenon is, you would have to do a much wider survey. And the other thing that came out that was the other thing that was interesting about that survey is the very low percentage of people who use formal mechanisms to complain, who use formal complaint mechanisms, people who've suffered different kinds of harassment, whether it's sexual or racial or abuse of power or that sort of thing. The proportion of people who come forward and use formal complaint mechanisms is extremely low. And when you ask them why they didn't complain officially, a lot of them will say, well, you know, I wanted to take care of it myself, or I didn't see the use of it. But a very, very significant percentage of people say that, you know, they worried that their work situation would become more unpleasant. They worried they would be labeled as a troublemaker. They worried that they would be blamed, that they would be scapegoated, that sort of thing. So that really speaks to that culture that exists within the Canadian Forces, that if you go ahead and if you complain and if you say out loud that you have a problem with a member of the team, you'll be seen as the problem, and oftentimes you'll be treated as an administrative burden, and people are afraid of that. And I think in some cases their fears are justified.
Thank you so much, Noemi.